It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, each and every day here on LRN.FM Network from beautiful Phoenix, Arizona, from the beautiful studios of Freedoms of the Nest, freedomsphoenix.com. I have my special guest on, Professor Joshua Stosher. He's a professor at Kent State University, and where he teaches Middle East politics and authoritarianism, and I want to make sure that we get an understanding of what's really going on in Egypt. Now, Professor, can you help me out, man? You know, I get the idea that whenever I'm watching cable news and so on, it's always what's going to be acceptable to the United States government and how they're going to transition. You've got Tony Blair on going, well, we can't just let the people decide. We got to take care of it. Well, tell me what it is. What's going on in Egypt?
I saw this reference by one of the people that I really respect and think about this. He called it a coup in slow motion. I believe that what we're seeing is the orderly transition, as the government has called it, from one military general to another military general. And I think your next president in Egypt is going to be General Omar Suleiman, who's going to be charged with leading a sort of political transition. And it's really going to come down to the protesters and who are essentially the representatives of a sort of abused citizenry. Do they repocket their demands and trust the government or not? And I think that's highly unlikely. I think that if you give the generals a chance to run this sort of transition, it's not going to end up being very democratic. I think Egypt's democratic window is closed.
Okay, all right, let me ask some specific questions here.
Sure.
One, I mean, from an economic sense, when you got, you know, half of the population living on $2, $3, $4 a day, and all of a sudden food jumps up 100% in the last year, you got some problems. And people go hungry, bow, 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 and they're in the freaking streets when that happens. So now we have, you change from one military dictatorship to another one. That's not going to address the economic issues. It's not going to address being hungry. How does that change when they change the face on the posters? I mean, well, right. How are they addressing that?
Well, you see, the real problem is that Hosni Mubarak's son, Gamal Mubarak, he was actually the one that was going to take over power in Egypt. They were going to have an inherited republic like they had in Syria. And Gamal Mubarak's whole stick was neoliberal economic policy. So from 2004 on, Egypt actually experienced 7.5% growth annually a year, which is actually tremendous growth. The problem was, while it got a class of people at the very top globally rich, what it did is it impoverished the lower end of society. So we saw this increasing gap between the rich and the poor growing. And so as you noticed with what's been going on in Egypt, one of the first things they did was hive off the Gamal Mubarak section of this regime. So I think actually the military leaders that are going to take over are going to be much more populist in their approach. I've already been talking with friends in Cairo, and what they're telling me is that the grocery stores are actually starting to get stocked with food again, and the food is at rock bottom prices.
Yeah.
Because the military is subsidizing everything because they're trying to get in with the population.
Well, you know, and their option is what? Of course, it's always about, it's why 43 plus million people in the United States are on food stamps. Right now, 40 out of 300 million, 43 million people. Why? It's to prevent exactly what's going on in Cairo. And I'm going, you know, how long can they sustain this? Is it just they're going to create a welfare system, bread and circuses for the masses? Is that their solution?
Well, you know, the United States had one of these situations before, too, back in the sort of Great Depression. And that's what actually led to the Great Deal, right? The New Deal by FDR. So, I mean, you know, I mean, this is essentially what the military leaders are trying to do. They're trying to create a situation where they're going to have a social safety net so that people stop protesting and start getting back into sort of what they would consider normal life. But, you know, the protesters, their demands aren't just for no to Mubarak. One of the things that the cable news channels have left off is that they are also expressly against being ruled by the military.
Well, they understand that the military is the United States. I mean, you know, it's not lost on them that we're supporting a lot of this, right?
Absolutely not. They're completely aware, as are all people that are sort of, you know, depressed and sort of, repressed. People, when you get repressed, you often know exactly where that's coming from.
Well, you know, tell me a little bit about that. What role did, some of the WikiLeaks cables, did that add fuel to the fire or just confirmation of what they've been saying? You know, saying, look, Ann, you want to see the U.S. State Department documents that says how much they're controlling all this stuff? Did that play a role in it at all?
No, I don't think the WikiLeaks really had a sort of, I mean, look, the way that we've talked about it as sort of professors of that study Egypt, WikiLeaks hasn't told us anything that we didn't know. It just confirmed everything we've been saying.
That's important to a lot of people on the ground there. They're going, oh, no, that doesn't mean it. Then you see it in print. All of a sudden, it gives it more validity.
Well, no, because the demands that they've had, these sort of no to Mubarak, no to military regime and stuff, this stuff all predates WikiLeaks. It all goes back. You can trace it back to 2005. You can trace it back to the U.S.-led invasion on Iraq. And you can trace it back to the Second Intifada, which was started in 2000. So, I mean, this all these demands and this discontent that they've had in Egypt, it really can be traced back there. And then when you couple that with the aggressive neoliberal politics they've been under since 2004, I think this is where you've had this explosive situation. But of course, you know, U.S. patronage and funding that regime to the tune of somewhere around $55 to $58 billion the last 31 years doesn't help.
You know, this is one thing that is of interest to me. You'll have an entire society that starts to come to the realization that all the promises that, you know, the light on the hill, you know, the United States government has been advocating for, over time they start to realize that it's really been a lie. I mean, is there still a warmness towards American citizens and against United States policy? Do they understand the difference, or they just hate Americans?
No, absolutely they understand the difference. I mean, Egyptians are very nuanced. They're very intelligent people. They understand that they do this sort of association. I'm Egyptian. Hosni Mubarak's my president. I'm not happy about that. How would I feel if people judge me by knowing that Hosni Mubarak was sort of my president? So it's the same way that they don't look at you and say, oh, my gosh, you know, Barack Obama's your president. George Bush is your president. Oh, you're a terrible person, right? They separate very well governments from people.
You know, one of the things I want to get into over our interview here is, how do you think it will play out? Because when we come back in the next segment, this is one thing I want to approach. You know, it's always, if you look at lines on a map, you look at different colored blocks on a globe, and you just kind of get that it's just, we're just a farm. You know, it's just, you know, livestock management tools. And like Egypt is going to come back with a new regime that, you know what, the livestock is getting unruly here. How do we get them calmed down? We're going to provide them more food, better grain, better drinking water. I mean, whatever it is, we're going to manage the livestock better in such a way that they won't rebel as much. But freedom, you know, is that what they're clamoring for, or they just want better food in their trough? You know, so when we come back, I want to get some kind of a beat on that. Do we have an understanding from the people that there's the source of their problems is not enough freedom? Is freedom the answer? What's the question? Or do they just want a little bit more from their government and they're clamoring for some more goodies? Well, that's what we'll get to when we come back here on Declare Your Independence with my special guest, Professor Joshua Stosher from Kent State University. We'll be right back.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock. My special guest, professor from Kent State, Joshua Stosher. Is that how you say your last name, Professor
Stacker? Stacker.
Stacker, you know, this is one thing that I want to try and get your perspective on, studying the Middle East and so on. I would imagine you study the Middle East in general and Arabic cultures and not just Egypt. Am I correct?
Yes.
And the one thing that I'm looking at is, what are the differences and or similarities between the ones that are starting to have this popular uprising? We got Yemen and the Sudan and Somalia and Saudi Arabia and Jordan and Syria, you know, whatever, you know, Libya, I imagine the whole thing's in flux, because culturally, Egypt is kind of like the most populous and probably the most popular. Their pop culture and movies and whatever comes from Egypt. So this has got to have an impact on the entire Middle East. And I'm wondering, the other countries there, how's their livestock managed differently, or is it the same?
No, I mean, they're quite different. I mean, you know, if you look at the Arabian Gulf, like where most of the majority of the oil is, you know, they have this sort of system, sort of a caretaker system from the grave, or from the cradle to the grave. So, you know, there's lots of money and people well taken care of. So you don't see the economic depravity that you see in sort of non-oil states. And then, of course, you know, there's this other variable. I mean, the one constant that kind of across all these states are they're highly repressive. And then I think the third variable is whether you are a client state of the United States or not.
And
I
which
think
ones
that really
aren't?
Matters.
Well, which ones aren't?
Syria. Pretty much Syria, Iran.
Well, this is why.
All.
Well, this is why they're always, you know, hey, we gotta go get Iran. You know, we gotta get Iran. Iran, bomb Iran. I mean, and why? Because, well, because they're not under our control. That's why. Because. So I'm going.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what else? You know. So then we have, you know, Syria has always been kind of a pain in our butt, and they kind of get a lot used to. I don't know how much they get support from Russia now, but, you know, it's kind of this power play going on. And then, of course, you always got Israel in the mix of everything and the Palestinian issue. So, I'm, you know, give me kind of a chess piece, risk, you know, game board of what's going on there. Where is the shifting of power? What role is Israel playing?
Well, Israel is actually not really said too much during the whole Cairo problem. Of course, this is a sort of major ally of Israel in the region, too, and it is the biggest Arab state, and they're conscious of that large Arab army to their, you know, sort of southwest. However, you know, I mean, so Israel's kind of been sort of largely playing the same kind of role as the sort of U.S. administration.
Secretly backing Mubarak and or military control.
Yes.
Because as far as they're concerned, it's all the same thing. You know, then we have, what could you give us some history on, you know, Nasser and Sadat and the rise of Mubarak? You got some history to give us on that?
Yeah, I mean, essentially the way that we kind of explain this is it's a tale of two regimes. You have the Gamal Abdel Nasser regime. He's officially in power from 1954 to 1970, and he leads what they call the sort of Arab socialism, but it's not really socialism. It's just state-led development. And the idea was that the state would be the chief engine of growth. The state obviously had sort of capital problems, so they were looking for foreign investment. They were looking for money from abroad. Nasser got into a sort of bidding war with the United States and the Soviet Union. The United States didn't want to back him. Well, they were going to give him money, but he had to, like, swear allegiance to, like, everything American. He didn't want to do that, so they wouldn't give him money, so he went with Russia or the Soviet Union. The state eventually exhausts. And when Sadat takes power, he sort of takes the entire system and reorients it. This is what we call the sort of, you know, the second regime. And this is the one that's based on neoliberal economic policies, the IMF, World Bank, and World Bank Washington Consensus.
So he joined the club.
And he's the one that, you know, signed up with the Americans. And basically, you know, if a human being can unilaterally sign a peace agreement, he signed a peace agreement unilaterally. And that's always why the peace treaty's always been a source of sort of contention in Egypt. Not because people want to tear it up and go to war. They don't want that. I honestly don't. They've all fought. Everybody has a family in Egypt who's lost members to war. They do not want to go to war. They do not hate Jews. It's not anything like this. But international treaties only work, or they work best when it's dependent on what the people who are underneath that treaty are getting. And so, you know, Hosni Mubarak, he inherited this whole situation in 1981, and the one thing we can say about Hosni Mubarak is
skipped a little bit there. I mean, you know, we had Sadat was assassinated.
Yeah, he was assassinated because he signed the peace treaty unilaterally, and he utterly pissed off his entire society.
Well, you had, I mean, as I remember,
then he started arresting everybody.
Well, I was in high school at the time, or so. Uh-huh. You know, I graduated '79, so it was around that time, and I'm going, you know, there was a parade, a military parade, and all of a sudden, you know, the guys marching in front of them break ranks and start shooting them.
Khaled Islamboli and three other people jumped out of a Jeep on the Autostrade in Nasser City and shot him, yeah. He had something like 34 bullets in him.
So Sadat, you know, substantially dead. Well, then what happened immediately following that? How did you know, Mubarak all of a sudden, he just said, okay, now I'm in charge?
No, he was the vice president at the time. So what happened is they, you know, the Speaker of the Parliament took over the country. They put they had an election. Mubarak won it, and that's the way it's been ever since. He's won, I think, five elections referendums in one election.
So are these elections contested, or are they considered to be
legitimate? The last election he had was contested in that it was multi-candidate. The four previous ones, he was the only candidate on the ballot. But that said, in the only contested election that he had, he still won 88% of the vote.
Is that, you know, stipulated too, or they thought it might have been rigged a little bit?
Oh, it's rigged.
Yeah, I'm shocked. Okay, yeah. So you have an actual contested election that goes through, and people go, yeah, you know, we don't, yeah, no. He's all of a sudden in the minds of the people, he's not legitimate anymore. You have, so they're going, you know, this democracy thing's not working out. And, you know, inflation starts to hit them. They're going hungry. Then they take to the streets. Well, who's on what side? You know, you talk about the role of the military and the police. Explain that to me. You know, what's the difference?
Well, I mean, they're all taking orders from the same people, right? I mean, there's been this talk about how the police disappeared, right? They got into the fight with the protesters, and all of a sudden the police disappeared, and the jails emptied, right? There was like simultaneous sort of prison breaks, right? And then there were these criminal elements running around town, and then the police came back, and we saw all the violence the other day. Police just don't disappear and reconstitute themselves on their own. That looks like an order, and this looks like a very disciplined regime. And what I'm arguing and what I'm trying to make the case for is that this has been completely regime managed the entire time. They're using one hand of the regime to play arsonist, right? They're using the police to play arsonist, cause a fight, get into a big problem, and they're using the other side of the regime, the military, to solve that problem. So therefore, they have the opposition and the protesters surrounded.
Well, when we come back, I want to make sure we get, hopefully, if we can understand the perspective of the people, what are they feeling? How do they see this play out, and what role are they going to have, or do they even have one? We'll talk about that more when we come back with Professor Joshua Stachur in just a little bit.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, each and every day here on the LRN.FM network from Phoenix, Arizona, beautiful studios of Freedoms with an S, freedomsphoenix.com. Go to freedomsphoenix.com. We've got all kinds of goodies there. Let me tell you, I want to show you this. Go on Google Translate. We got our revolutionary throwing the bouquet of flowers, not a firebomb, not a Molotov cocktail like they, you know, generally depicted as doing, but throwing a bouquet of flowers for the slogan, "We know the truth." What's Google Translate do for me? It gives me the translated version in Arabic right there. Oh, see, we are getting the presses going. We're going to send this next week. We're already all over it. As before I even finish the show, we got the boys working on it. That's how we roll. And, you know, what you may not know, Professor, is we're the ones that started the Ron Paul Lovevolution. That logo, the Ron Paul Revolution, I'm the one that came up with that logo. And we start sending this kind of material that we had over the past few years to the English-speaking and people that can translate into Cairo, guess what's going to happen? We're going to have us some fun. That's what's going to happen. And I'm so neat in understanding from what the perspective is of the educated, uneducated, the rank and file, the people in Cairo. They're sitting there looking at all of this and thinking what's really going on. What's their perspective?
In Egypt?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they have quite a bunch of different perspectives. I mean, you have sort of communists and socialists and liberals and pan-Arabists and Islamists. And, you know, there's quite a wide range of thinking. I mean, one of the things that they all kind of come along and agree on is that they're tired of the Mubarak presidency. They're tired of corruption and they're tired of the military generals ruling them. They want to rule themselves. And so, you know, I think that what we as sort of Americans and what the United States government should be doing is amplifying the sort of clearly articulated voices that we've heard from the protesters. And, you know, I mean, I'm really not afraid of Egyptian democracy. They're smart enough to handle it. They're, you know, rational human beings. They can figure out their own problems. They don't need us standing over top of them.
They got a culture that's thousands of years old, bearing since pharaohs, man. I mean, you know, they probably got a clue, you know. So and even if they didn't, I don't care if they're from the jungle. They can make up their own mind without us. And I'll tell you this one thing. A lot of the YouTubes and Facebooks, and so we've been posting a lot of this stuff on our news site. And what it looks like is they're going, look, we just want the United States to go away. They don't want our interference. They don't want our involvement. Is that a common theme, you think?
Yeah, I mean, look, they have no problem with Americans. They just are tired of being a sort of vassal of the American Empire and policy, the American Empire's policy in the region. So, you know, it's not anti-Americanism, like they hate us, but They would just rather be left alone.
I'm hip to that. Well, tell us about other countries. Let's get, you know, Yemen, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan, and the difference there is what?
Well, I mean, the differences are quite wide. I mean, one is just demographics. Two or second level is just level of development. You know, obviously the United States has a very intimate relationship with Jordan and Egypt and not so much Yemen. Also, you know, Jordan has signed a peace agreement with Israel, so that's an important factor. You know, Yemen is a quite underdeveloped country. It has the highest birth rates in the world. You know, the president there really hasn't built a lot of roads and things. So there's a lot going on there. And the Arab world, I mean, it's a fabulously diverse place. The 22 countries, many different religions, many different sort of points of view. And, you know, I would just encourage everybody to go kind of explore it and you know.
Well, you know, you make it kind of the point is that the more diverse you are, the less likely you are to homogenize anything. And freedom is the only common factor everybody can, you know, relate to, is just to be left alone to be whatever you are. And I'm going, you know, the Western culture, oh, heck no. We need you to sign on to the IMF. We need you to get indebted. We need the economic hitman to come in and say, you know, Mr. Leader Man that we put here, it's either your brains or your signature on this piece of paper, or we got a CIA operation coming in and change your regime that we just put in place. I mean, this happens over and over and over and over. And if that doesn't work, we got a battleship. So I'm going, you know, at some point, these people have to see, certainly in the Middle East, as you have access to information via the internet, because it takes only a very, very short period of time. We saw it happen here in the United States in the 2008 election cycle, to where an entire generation began to understand that what they had been told in junior high and their social studies class, that's not what America really is. They figured it out. They go, oh, I get it. And it doesn't take very long. So tell me, you know, what role the internet has played, even on poor people. We're seeing they're using Twitter and Facebook, and they're coming out and sharing information instantaneously. And whatever goes viral and sparks has an enormous impact on millions of people. Has the internet played into, you know, what you think the future is?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it has played an important role. But, you know, Egypt has a quite low internet penetration, rating. I mean, it's only about a quarter of the population is on the internet. And the organizers that I've talked to, and I've asked this question to numerous times of them, has always been the same. Look, we use the internet not to organize. We're not organizing politically on the internet. We're organizing politically the old-fashioned way. We're going door to door. We're handing out pamphlets. We're, you know, we're having conversations with groups that we don't agree with. You know, we use the internet. We use Twitter. We use Facebook to amplify what we're saying, to publicize what we're doing, not to, like, we're not relying on it to bring people into the square. And, you know, I mean, in all honesty, I think there's been a lot of evidence that this is true, because remember,
they shut it down.
Shut it down, and it had no impact.
I think it amped it up even more.
Yeah, so it had no, I mean, so the internet is for publicity. It's not for organization. If you politically organize on the internet, you run the risk of, fragmenting.
Well, the one thing that we saw was a common theme, certainly with the media and other countries and the rhetoric of the talking heads, was when they shut down the internet, they lost a lot of credibility. And certainly with the people around the world, because the first thing, the ability, I mean, even you have the talking heads, regardless of what they really wanted, you know, you'd have them all, you know, you lost your credibility. You know, everybody's got to be able to express themselves, you know, while they try and make permanent the Patriot Act and do all kinds of other surveillance and closed circuit televisions every freaking where in this country. They're such hypocrites, you know, but they'll come out and they'll say, hey, man, you know, you gotta let the people express themselves. It's easier to find them.
right.
You know, so that's another aspect of this. Is there going to be repercussions, kind of like China had with Tiananmen Square?
Well, we're going to find out. I mean, I think the jury's still out. The military generals that are currently governing that country, I mean, have been incredibly ruthless against journalists. And particularly, you know, the foreign journalists have been really good about publicizing this. And the way that I explain this to my, you know, my classes when they ask me about what I thought about what was going on to the journalists, I respect Anderson Cooper. I think he does a good job. And, you know, I'm sorry that he got smacked around a little bit the other day on the streets of Cairo.
Yeah, but he's lucky.
But, yeah, you should see what they're doing to the Egyptian journalists. I've just got a confirmed report that the first Egyptian journalist has died, shot in the head. So, we have to be very sort of steadfast in sort of stopping and condemning sort of all attacks on journalists. And this is why I really wish that the White House and the administration would speak up a little louder.
Well, are we going to have a Tiananmen moment?
No, we're not.
You don't think so?
Absolutely not. And I'll give you the reason why, because right now...
We got to wait till after the break. The reason why we're not going to have a Tiananmen Square moment, so the tank's rolling in, and, you know, this time they stand in front of the tank, they just might get run over like the police van go plowing through people. So we'll find out from Professor Joshua Stotcher from Kent State University, Middle East Studies. We'll find out why there's not going to be a Tiananmen moment when we come back in just a little bit.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence. Yeah, just to make sure, I go on my Google Translator and I take the We Know the Truth in Arabic and then see what it says in English. We Know the Truth. Man, you know, that's one thing that I want to emphasize. with the internet and the tools available, and you just got your Android and your apps, I mean, you can just communicate immediately. Google comes out with a universal translator. I just go blah, 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 push the button, boom. Tells you, you know, it's happening right, not later. And it's all of these teenagers that just have no use for the type of government that they've grown up and seen, you know, how it's beaten down their families. And they got an entire life ahead of them to look forward to that when they know what's going on through the internet and the lifestyles of people all over the world. And they're going, you know what? I don't think I'm going to accept this. And you have lovelutions. That's what happens. Hopefully they're lovelutions. You know, well, as they get into this, what happens, Professor? I mean, are we, you don't think that there's going to be a Tiananmen Square moment where you have the regime's going, you know what, we know how to put an end to this. It's called tanks.
Well, you know, that option is on the table, and I think that would be extremely tragic. But I don't think there's good reason to think it won't happen. One is a the fuzzy soft one, and then the other one is just the good hard consideration. And the fuzzy soft one is that, you know, the Egyptian military holds pride of place in the Egyptian public, in their collective memory. So it would be very difficult to make that call and break that sort of long-standing sort of solidarity in the Egyptian collective memory. But, you know, you could say to me, well, okay, that sounds great, but yeah, if you got to shoot, shoot. All right. And to that, I would apply the hard consideration, and that is that the Egyptian military has been the power behind the throne in Egypt since 1952. So they are effectively ruling without governing, which is a beautiful place to be. Secondly, the Egyptian military holds massive economic interests in the country. They handle everything from bottled water to bread to olive oil to Jeep assembly, tires, cement, construction, you name it, and the Egyptian military in some way, shape, or form is involved in it. So seeing that it's so positioned so well politically and economically in the country and within the sort of confines of the state, they fire one bullet and they risk losing the state. So I think that there's just a really good, hard economic reason for why they won't do it.
Yeah, right up until they do. I mean, we have here in the United States, that was the whole point. After the Civil War, we got this posse comitatus thing. And they go, you know what? Yeah, we don't really need that posse comitatus anymore. You know, and we at least went through the charade of just saying, yeah, we're just going to kind of do away with that. Well, do they have it in writing in some way in Egypt, or is it just kind of a cultural thing? They got a law, they got to change what?
No, I just don't really see them risking everything they have.
Unless they see it already at risk. I mean, when it's obvious that the people are not going, you know, the last result of a tyrant is to be more tyrannical.
Right, yeah. Well, judging from the comments coming out of Cairo from the new vice president, the prime minister, and the outgoing president, my sense is they feel like they have the upper hand and they see the daylight at the end of this problem, so all they got to do is hold on. So I think they figure they've won this, and by all accounts, as much as it hurts my heart to say this, I think they have.
And what do you mean by they're going to give up Mubarak as coming up? Kind of sacrificial lamb and then throw in another guy?
Mubarak has been absorbing a lot of punches in their rope-a-dope strategy, and I believe that they'll eventually have him retire in Egypt. He's not going to get on a plane and be exiled. He's not doing exile.
Why?
Because it would set a very dangerous precedent for how you kick a leader out. Egypt's a very proud nation and it's a country that doesn't want to be shamed into watching their president go away in exile. So I think that while the people want him to be on a plane and want him to be exiled, the military ruling establishment, that's one of their sort of untouchable conditions.
All right. Let me give some predictions here.
Okay, let's predict.
My prediction is this. Food must be on the shelves for a sustained period of time at a low enough price that people do not go hungry. Period.
Okay.
That doesn't happen, all bets are off. Now, you're saying that the military and the regime, whoever, is flooding the grocery shelves with some food at a rock-bottom low price to kind of, you know, quell the dissent. But yep. I'm saying when that stops, should it stop, inflation keeps going up throughout the Middle East. I don't see how we are doing this just central banking, printing of money, inflation rampant across the planet. That is not going to stop. It will get to the point that they will not be able to afford to do it. There will be food shortages at any price. So I'm going, when that happens, all this goes away.
I guess I'm on the other side of that one. I don't see the military seeing that happening since they're in charge of the food.
So they're going to manufacture food.
Absolutely.
Pull it out of their tanks.
Well, they already make food. They're in charge of olive oil. They're in charge of bottled water. They're in charge of bread. I mean, you know, they're already in these industries.
So you have any economic training? I mean, you understand where I'm going with this. I mean, you know, you can sit there and wish it all you want. If it's not there, it's not there.
I understand. No, I'm just on the other side of it. I think it will be there.
Okay. We have February 4th, 2011. You're pretty confident that they're going to be able to keep the stocks, the shelves stocked for how long? A year, forever, what?
Pretty much, let's say the next year.
Okay, so we'll go before, between now and certainly a year
from
now.
Super Bowl next year.
That by Super Bowl next year, we're going to have a stable, the military is going to maintain control in Egypt.
I can do that. But, I mean, look, I mean, there is one little small caveat. The people that are protesting are going to be very disappointed and very pissed off, and there's going to be no getting around that. But, you know, this is the exact same state they were in before they revolted on January 25th.
I don't see it. The economics come in. I mean, it's math. I mean, it's simple math. We have never been in this situation before. You know, we look at, you know, riots in Greece and in Italy and Iceland, Ireland. You know, it starts in France. I mean, it starts going in these more sophisticated, developed, westernized countries around the same kind of things. And you start getting into these poorer countries where you have an even larger percentage of the people that, you know, you can throw out a bunch of bread, but sooner or later, math catches up. That's just the way it is. So, you know, I got time. We'll wait. You know, we got a year to go here. Well, what about the other countries? Saudi Arabia, does that seem stable?
Yes.
Because?
They haven't really had any protests yet.
Yemen?
They've had some protests, and the president has promised that he won't run again for the presidency in 2013. I don't know if that's going to be enough to starve them off, but right now, I say stable.
Jordan?
Jordan's a wild card. I'm not entirely sure. I'd say 50-50.
Syria?
I'd say 85% stable.
So are they dominoes? Does one, you know, Egypt certainly you would think have an impact on the others.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's going to really depend on how Egypt turns out, right? I mean, the domino for Egypt was Tunis, right? And what happened in Tunis? They chased the leader out, but all the same goons that used to run the country are still there. So, you know, changing the leader and not changing the regime, you know, is not exactly a revolution.
So do you see it like a genie out of the bottle thing or stuff back in? Is there, you know, a realization of individual power or just information? Or, I mean, imagine this. You know, I've had CIA guys from the Cold War on and we're talking about different things that were effective and such. And I'm going, you know, it seems to me that if you just translated the Declaration of Independence into whatever local language and dumped it out of airplanes, you'd have more impact. And they go, you know, that kind of thing was the most effective propaganda they ever did through Air America. I mean, through Voice of America and different publications and so on. And I see the same, which is what we're going to do. It's what we are going to do right here. Declare your independence. Freedom's Phoenix. Libertarian Party, United States. International Society of Individual Liberty. We're going to send some goodies over to Cairo and see what happens. You know, and we'll keep you informed, okay, Professor? Because I think it'll be of interest to you. Well, thanks for coming on. I appreciate your time. And we'll be with you next week, Monday. We're going to have Citizen X, Glenn Jacobs, is going to give his perspective on what's going on here on Declare Your Independence. We'll talk to you Monday.
Uncovering the secrets and exposing the lies. That's what readersoffreedomsphoenix.com get every day. Readersoffreedomsphoenix.com are constantly provided the information that detail the real news between the lines of propaganda about government policies and the true relationship we all have with coercive governments. Learn the true condition of our economy, innovations and technological breakthroughs in energy, health, computer science, and space travel. Learn the truth well before it's admitted to in the lamestream media, the media that is so last century. Corporate media has evolved into nothing more than distributors of government propaganda, but we now have a fantastic alternative. FreedomsPhoenix.com provides constant news updates on the issues that affect our lives in the most important ways. Our liberty and our property are under constant attack, and FreedomsPhoenix.com provides the understanding behind the propaganda while encouraging the participation of our readers. Join us at FreedomsPhoenix.com. That's Freedoms with an S, Phoenix.com. FreedomsPhoenix.com, where the revolution between the ears has already matured.